is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The restaurants are full. The shops are full. I see even elderly people who have vaccinated now. They are in those restaurants and they are not wearing their masks because they think, well, I have vaccinated.
That's David Makhura, Premier of South Africa's Gauteng province, on how citizens lowering their guard has contributed to the third wave of COVID-19. Details coming up. Also, gunmen ambush a group of police officers in Burkina Faso, killing at least 11. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Vote counting continues in Ethiopia after voting Monday and Tuesday in the country's national election. Life in the capital, Addis Ababa, is normal, but in the country's Tigray region, the war continues with new reports of airstrikes and military action. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch has been in Ethiopia for the past few weeks, and she spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about what she is seeing and hearing. The conversation begins with an update on the vote counting.
The election board said last night that the preliminary results would be available in 5 days, and the official results are expected to be available within 2 weeks. There are many places that have postponed their vote until September. And they're postponing for security reasons, so we can also assume they're going to reassess later in the summer as to when exactly those votes are going to take place. We spoke to an analyst the other day who said that while it will take some time to get all of those seats filled to have people represented in parliament, he said the electoral math would not change based on these late votes. He believes that there will be a strong majority in parliament from this round of elections, and that will be enough to form a government.
Now, there are reports of new fighting in Tigray, including airstrikes. What are you hearing about that?
I just got off the phone with a young man in Tigray who is in the city of Adigrat, and that city, over the past few days, has, according to him, changed hands twice. There's been some violence there, but mostly without fighting. There's been reports, as you said, of airstrikes in other areas and roads closed. But in this city, what he said happened is that the TPLF, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, I guess now known as the rebel forces, but once was essentially the ruling party of Ethiopia for decades, they came back into the town after having been ousted by the Ethiopian government forces. And not just that town, but other nearby towns, and Ethiopian forces withdrew within the following hours. So they had taken over overnight, and by lunchtime, Eritrean forces came into town, and the TPLF once again left. There wasn't actually fighting on the ground, as far as he could know, in the city. There was some violence. Some houses were destroyed.
What is the response in the capital about the fighting?
In the capital, it's actually surprising how little concern there is among many people. The people here in Addis are, of course, aware of the humanitarian crisis taking place in Tigray. A lot of people believe it is exaggerated and it is not as bad as a lot of the media says. I've heard from many people that the international media is biased and exaggerates claims of abuses in Tigray. There's a lot of people in the capital who take the TPLF position very personally. The TPLF ruled Ethiopia essentially for decades, and the regime was repressive and sometimes violent. It was famed for locking up people who had different opinions, politicians, activists, journalists. So there's a lot of people that were victims of this regime that see the TPLF as just a continuation of the old regime, and the fact that they're fighting Ethiopian forces is the crime, not the suffering of the people. Or if the suffering of the people is the crime, it's the TPLF's fault. not the government's fault. So this is a pretty common thought in the Capitol. It's also, I think, to a lot of people here, very far away, and one of several conflicts. We've been focusing on the Tigray conflict, as it's the most active and the most current war, but there are conflicts in several other regions. And so people in the Capitol think of the Tigray conflict often as one of several conflicts, as opposed to the large humanitarian crisis you see if you're reading media reports.
That was VOA correspondent Heather Murdock in Addis Ababa. She was speaking with VOA editor Kate Pound Dawson today. And in a related story, Ethiopia's elections mark the first test of voter support for Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, Africa's youngest leader and the first in the country from the Oromoya region. Experts believe that electing Abiy Ahmed, backed by an expected majority in parliament, can have regional implications, especially on the Horn of Africa and the Nile downstream countries. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained these implications to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
There are many potentially important regional implications from these elections. That's a precedent for competitive elections. You know, the Greater Horn of Africa and East Africa more generally lag far behind Southern and West Africa in terms of the quality of democracy. So given the size of Ethiopia's population and its leadership role on the continent, to the extent that Ethiopia can make tangible progress in its democratic systems, it shifts the norms and expectations for elections elsewhere in the Greater Horn. You know, I think it's also highly significant that these elections offer the opportunity for more participation and representation in Ethiopia's most populous regions, something that we haven't seen under the minority-ruled EPRDF. And we could take that back further, that we really have not seen popular representation throughout Ethiopia's history. And so to the extent that Ethiopia can move in these directions, it's an important milestone for the region, especially with the complicated transitions we're observing in Sudan and Somalia. And so it may provide something of a guidepost for expectations and ways forward. I think the age factor is also notable. Africa is the world's youngest region. At the same time, it's typified by aging leaders who have stayed in power past their constitutionally mandated term limits. So the potential precedent that Abiy represents as a young elected leader is noteworthy.
Abiy Ahmed made the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam a national pride project, playing a vital role in the country's development, providing large amounts of hydropower. Egypt and Sudan said he showed no flexibility whatsoever in negotiations with them, even with U.S. mediation. If elections provided him with electoral mandate, political legitimacy, and consensus, how could that impact the already troubled negotiations with the downstream countries?
Over the past year, really since Ethiopia has begun filling the dam, Ethiopia has become increasingly reluctant to engage in negotiations with Egypt and Sudan over the management of the dam and the water flow. So it's hard to say what's going to happen following the election, especially if it provides electoral victory and greater legitimacy for Abiy. Historically, around the world and Africa, we've seen that democracies, countries that are more democratic, are more prone to mediation, and they have incentives to avoid conflict. Moreover, democracies tend to be more interconnected with the international system, and therefore they have incentives to maintain positive relationships with their key international partners. So to the extent that Abiy gains legitimacy and he has incentives to act more democratically and doesn't feel isolated internationally, I believe it's going to increase the likelihood that Ethiopia will resume negotiations in good faith, trying to reach some final agreements on the GERD.
How about the implication of his election regarding the border dispute with Sudan?
Well, I think the same pattern will hold if Abiy is increasingly seen as a democratically elected leader. Then he has incentives to maintain that reputation and to try and resolve differences through mediation rather than through conflict. And, you know, I think the leaders in Sudan have also shown a willingness to negotiate And so I think this border conflict has always been something that is resolvable through negotiation. Neither side has a lot to gain by starting another conflict, given the other serious challenges they face. And so, I think to the extent that Abiy is seen as the increasingly legitimate leader, it increases the latitude he'll have to try to find a negotiated settlement.
Was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Gunmen have ambushed a group of police officers in Burkina Faso, killing at least 11. According to the Associated Press, this is one of the deadliest attacks of its kind yet in the West African country, where extremist violence is escalating. Burkina Faso's security ministry confirmed in a statement yesterday at least 4 other officers were missing after Monday's attack near the town of Barassalogo in the volatile country's northern region. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. Islamic extremists are suspected. Violence linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State has devastated Burkina Faso, killing thousands and displacing millions since 2016. South Africa is in panic mode as the third wave of COVID-19 wreaks havoc across the country. Daily infections and fatalities have more than doubled. Authorities say the country's economic hub, Johannesburg, in Gauteng province, is the worst affected and is swiftly running out of hospital beds. Now, President Ramaphosa says imposing tougher restrictions cannot be ruled out. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
2 weeks before the expected peak of the COVID-19 third wave in South Africa, authorities say infections are already out of control. From a daily average infection of around 4,000 2 weeks ago, that number is now above 10,000. Daily fatalities have tripled to 297 recorded in the past 24-hour cycle. Donnie Fick, a doctor at Milpark Hospital in Johannesburg, says hospitals are quickly filling up.
It is so difficult to access a private hospital bed in the city at the moment. I mean, lots of big clinics, all in a very concentrated area. You can't get a patient admitted. It is so hard. You have to make so many phone calls and hope and pray that they will take a patient who's got oxygen saturation of 80%.
Bruce Melado is a member of the Gauteng COVID-19 Advisory Committee.
This wave is fueled more than ever, more than the other two, by mobility and non-compliance to social distancing measures. And the level of adherence also is lower than the second wave.
Gauteng Premier David Makura says citizens have lowered their guard.
The rate at which infections are happening is only a function of mobility. The restaurants are full, the shops are full. I see even elderly people who have vaccinated now, they are in those restaurants and they are not wearing their masks because they think, well, I have vaccinated. It is dangerous. So behavior can help us a great deal.
Ramaphosa admits that the country finds itself in a difficult position.
We are seeing infection rates that seem to be much higher than what we have seen before. The deployment of more medical personnel is obviously one of the things we need, as well as hospital beds, and of course, the challenge of oxygen availability and ventilators is another one.
To date, over 1.8 million people have been infected with COVID-19 in South Africa. Fatalities have exceeded 59,000. However, just over 2 million people have received their first dose of vaccination, leading to great concerns over the country's preparedness for the peak of the third wave. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Zimbabwe, farmers, consumers and economists say the smuggling of goods across the border between Zimbabwe and its neighbors is wreaking socio-economic havoc. From Bulawayo, Erigando has the story.
Millers in the country's western region of Matabeleland have laid off 1,000 workers. The Grain Millers Association of Zimbabwe blames the layoffs on smuggled imports flooding the local market. After lobbying from GMAZ, the government last month imposed a ban on the importation of grain and from products made from millet, coarse flour made from maize coming from South Africa. Zimbabwe relies on imports of basic goods and commodities from South Africa. A SNAP survey by VOA on the streets of Bulawayo reveals that these include basic goods such as cooking oil, sugar, bathing soap, flour, rice, and millet. A bottle of imported cooking oil sells for US$3.50 on the parallel market, while a locally manufactured brand goes for about 500 Zimbabwean dollars or about $5 using the official exchange rate. Additionally, a 12.5 kg bag of imported millet meal is selling at US$3.50. That's less than a locally produced 10 kg bag of millet meal packet, which costs US$5. Observers note that authorities blame vendors, traders, and others in the informal market for the smuggling. Michael Ndiweni of the Bulawayo Vendors and Traders Association says middlemen procure the goods in bulk for resale to members of his association and to others in the informal market. He and other observers say while smuggling in the country poses a serious risk to the economy, locally manufactured goods do not seem to be able to compete against the imports.
Cheaper in South Africa, that even if you order it and sell it in Zimbabwe as an example, you still make a bit of a profit. So which could be the reason why it's cheaper to buy imported millet?
Ndiweni blames even bigger players for the proliferation of imported goods on the country's streets.
But usually ordinary people may not be doing that, because ordinary people will be bringing maybe very few commodities for resale as compared to the big firms that bring a lot of goods. So ordinarily, if you see huge quantities of millet imported then in the market, it means that there are bigger players who are perhaps smuggling, and then maybe they have these people who are selling now as their runners.
For instance, the Minister of Finance has publicly revealed that the country is losing millions each month through gold smuggling, while the Police Commissioner General Godwin Matanga also admitted to the porous nature of the country's borders before a parliamentary portfolio committee, saying police are under-equipped. Economic analyst Oswald Bina weighs in, saying criminal syndicates have the financial and possible political muscle to push volumes of goods across the border illegally.
There is significant thresholds of an underground economy, a very vibrant and lethal economy that survives within the armpits of the strong and the world to do. Zimbabwe finds itself in that realm and needs to work on its institutions. Our institutions, which are supposed to be superintending over mitigating the effects of rampant corruption, rampant smuggling, rampant pilferage, appear to have been weakened to the core.
Bina and other analysts say that the economy is a hostage to shadowy and linked individuals who illegally smuggle millions of dollars worth of goods from foodstuff to precious metals and tobacco. They urge the government to take action if the economy and consumers are to thrive. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The African penguin is in trouble. It is considered by wildlife conservationists to be an endangered species, with an estimated 13,000 pairs left in South Africa, compared to 140,000 in the 1950s. South Africa and neighboring Namibia, where there are said to be 5,000 pairs, are the only places that penguins breed. Reporter Vicky Stark takes a look at the effort to increase their numbers.
Christina Hagen is a fellow of penguin conservation at BirdLife South Africa, an organization that works with communities to protect birds and their habitats. She says the main reason the population is decreasing is because there isn't enough food. This is mainly due to climate change and competition from the fishing industry. Hagen says penguins eat mostly sardines and anchovies, which are no longer plentiful on South Africa's west coast, where they breed.
What BirdLife South Africa is doing is trying to focus on the lack of food. So we are trying to create new colonies in areas of high food abundance. So the south coast, or the southern coast of South Africa, does have good fish availability. And so that's why we're working in that area. And we've chosen the Dhurup Nature Reserve, where penguins tried to breed naturally in the mid-2000s. So we've chosen that as a spot to try and create, or to re-establish, this colony.
When the penguins tried to breed there before, they fell prey to predators like caracal, so now they've fenced in the area to protect them should they settle there again. Hagen says they recently released 30 juvenile penguins at De Hoop. They were rescued as eggs after being abandoned at Stony Point Penguin Colony and hand-reared by the South African Foundation for the Conservation of Coastal Birds. Along with Cape Nature, they partner with BirdLife SA on the colony project. Why would the penguin eggs be abandoned?
If the adults start molting at the wrong time, so molting is when they replace all their feathers and they're basically stuck on land for 2 or 3 weeks, which obviously means they can't bring food back for their chicks. So then they unfortunately abandon the nest.
In the years to come, more rescued juveniles will be released at De Hoop Nature Reserve when they're about 100 days old. Hagen and her colleagues are planning for them to leave the ocean and return to the site when they're ready to breed in 3 to 6 years' time. Lifelike dummy penguins have been planted there, and penguin calls are broadcast to make it look and sound like there's already a colony.
There have been other seabird colony establishments using this method or similar, you know, releasing chicks. And from those lessons, it seems that you need to keep doing it for a while in order to have a greater chance of success.
To learn more about the penguins' habits, they've also fitted 2 of them with GPS devices. Everyone's hoping they'll all easily find their way back to De Hoop and start their families. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of American News in Cape Town.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Gihigi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500.